This is News in No Time. Tony Cox in for Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, America's mayor wants to be America's next president. Fallout from an alleged cover-up shakes the Pentagon. And don't call me articulate. Why that's such a buzzword for black folks. Joining us to take on these topics on today's roundtable are E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism at Hofstra University School of Communication. We also have Jeff Obafemi-Carr and Ron Christie, VP of the lobbying firm DC Navigators and former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Hello, everybody.
Hey, Tony.
Listen, we have a number of topics to get through today, so I'm going to try to push the agenda a little quicker than we normally do, but I'd like to have a brief discussion with you, really briefly, about what we just heard in our opening segment from the two young African-Americans who are living with HIV. ER, I suppose the question is how we can expect young people to raise their consciousness about HIV/AIDS when a lot of adults don't.
That's very true, but I think things are changing sufficiently. Last summer, there was the launch of a new campaign, an awareness campaign. Civil rights organizations, major churches, BET, and others in the communications field decided to get involved in a call for action. And they all pledged that they were going to get the word out to young people as well as to adults. One of the alarming statistics we're seeing these days is that HIV/AIDS is growing very fast among older black women, many of whom are ashamed to ask their partners to wrap it up, as the young people are saying. And then they're ashamed when they become infected.
Well, what do you think, Jeff, will take to drive the message home?
I think it's going to take people thinking about this disease on a whole new level and how it really affects, effects and infects people that they know. I was talking once to a person who was talking about the transition in the age gap between the civil rights movement and the current generation and how people tend to blame the kids for ignorance. And he was saying it was like we were great guitar players, but we weren't the greatest teachers. So people suffered. So I think now people in positions of leadership now have to become great teachers. So preachers who are used to speaking to people now have to become good teachers. They have to shirk the shame and start talking about issues that I know are uncomfortable. The same thing with educators, the same thing with people who just interact with people on an everyday basis. We have to really let people know that this is in an epidemic space. And when ER mentioned black women, especially, you're talking about 25 years old to 34 in that childbearing age, we have to get rid of the shame that makes us not want to talk about this disease, because just because we don't believe it's there doesn't mean that it isn't.
Well, let me move on to the next topic. And Ron, I'm going to come to you. I apologize for not giving you a chance to chime in on this, but I want to come to you when we talk about Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York, filing a so-called statement of candidacy with the Federal Election Commission, making him eligible to raise money for a presidential campaign. Here he is.
It is not just about ideologies. It isn't about political parties. It's about who can do it better for our city, our state, and our country.
So one of the questions I have for you, Ron, is this. Can America's mayor, as he is affectionately known, become the GOP front runner despite his stances on abortion, stem cell research, etc.? Early polls seem to say yes, but maybe.
I think he can be. I think his entry into this race is a very important dynamic for the Republican Party. For so much of the commentary that you hear on the airwaves, you hear, oh, well, if you're not pro-life and if you're not in certain, if you look at social litmus tests, if you will, if you don't vote the right way or believe the right way in certain issues, that you'll never make it past the early primary states and then thus not get the nomination. I think with Rudy Giuliani, what you see here is a dynamic individual, a former U.S. prosecutor who cleaned up New York City when he was the mayor of the city of New York, and someone who a lot of people have a lot of respect for his leadership and his ability on 9/11. So I do think he can win. It will be incumbent for Giuliani to make a strong impression in the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary. But absolutely, I think he has the ability to raise the money. I think he has the stature. And ultimately, should Senator Clinton become the Democratic nominee, he has the wherewithal to take her on in a head-to-head in the general election.
ER, would you contrast for us, if you don't mind, his candidacy, the candidacy of Giuliani, with that of, let's say, Barack Obama?
That's an interesting contrast. Obama is a fresh face on the scene, so he doesn't have the kind of baggage that Giuliani has. And I say that, I know you introduced the topic by saying that Giuliani was America's mayor. Well, if you knew Rudy the way we in New York knew Rudy before September 11, you would know that there are a lot of complicated issues there with him. He was not always sensitive to the rights of people, civil liberties. He was not sensitive to blacks and Latinos or poor people. He was not a very nice guy. He didn't have a great temperament. So I think in all of those rough edges, Obama has him beat. When it comes to fundraising, he still may be able to trade upon that America's mayor thing until people do get to know Rudy the way we know Rudy.
You know, one of the things, Jeff, that I was thinking about as I pondered the candidacy of Rudy Giuliani, as well as that of Barack Obama, is the issue of their foreign policy. And how would you characterize, and perhaps it's too early to be able to characterize, the kind of foreign policy stance that will, characterize Giuliani's candidacy?
Well, one of the things that you have to look at is what stage people are used to debating these issues on. Barack Obama and other national figures, even John McCain, are used to at least debating the concept of how to relate to other countries in a position of power to affect and to affect those countries, to affect foreign policy. Giuliani, of course, is mayor of a very diverse city. Of course, does not have the opportunity or the experience to actually have to interact with other countries. And, of course, I need to point out that that term America's mayor is like the term America's team. It's a marketing term more than anything. Mm-hmm. It depends on who you ask. Some people who said, hey, he's not my mayor, especially when you're talking about certain populations that are underserved in New York City. So in some cases, I think Giuliani he's a strong candidate. He's very articulate, so to speak, and he articulates a lot of the angst of America. But I think he might be the best thing to happen to the Democratic Party simply because of some of his liabilities in the long term, some of his history with women, and some of his strength that is unwavering and unbending that I don't think you need in an elder statesman of the United States.
Well, certainly his entry into the race will ramp things up. We'll keep our eye on that. We're going to move on to another topic, but before we do, let me just say, if you are listening and just joining us on News in No Time, Tony Cox, and with me on today's roundtable are E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism at Hofstra University School of Communication, Jeff Obafemi-Carr, who you just heard, host of the radio show Freestyle. He's in Nashville, Tennessee. And also Ron Christie, VP of the lobbying firm DC Navigators. He is the author of Black in the White House and former special assistant to President George W. Bush. All right, moving on to our next topic, friendly fire. A video was recently leaked to the media revealing the reaction of an American pilots, after U.S. troops killed a British soldier during a friendly fire incident in Iraq in the early stages of the war. Lance Corporal Matty Hull died when soldiers fired on his convoy nearly 4 years ago. First, it was said that there was no video, but now the Pentagon just says that they won't release it, but of course, it's too late. Here's my question. I'm going to come to you, E.R., first. How do you temper situations like this? I mean, what obligation, if any, does the Pentagon have here?
Well, I think the Pentagon's position is that it was holding on to the tape as part of its investigation. Anytime there's friendly fire, it's a tragedy. It's clearly the Allies did not mean to shoot upon each other. So the thing to do is to learn from the era. What went wrong? Now, often what the problem is not so much the friendly fire incident, but the actions of perhaps cover-up or what appears to be cover-up. And I think that's still being debated in this situation.
Yes, it is, as a matter of fact. And there have been other so-called cover-ups in this war on terror. One of the most recognized was that of former NFL player turned Army Ranger Pat Tillman. Ron Christie, what do you think the obligation of the administration is with regard to this incident and how it is being handled from this point forward?
I think, as ER just said, every time that you go to battle and every time that there is a friendly fire accident, it's a tragedy and it's a terrible loss of life. And Tony, you just mentioned what happened with Pat Tillman. Again, another terrible tragedy and loss of life. I think the Pentagon and the military officials have an obligation to fully investigate not only what happened at the time of that friendly fire accident, but what has happened in the subsequent years after that initial accident. Was there a cover-up? Was there an attempt to deceive? Or was that material classified for reasons to protect either troops on the ground or localities or other means or disseminations of intelligence that you don't want those who are our enemies to have? So it's important, I think, for the United States government to be fully conversant with their British allies about what happened and to be transparent. But at the same time, we don't want to give our enemies information that's classified or sensitive, should that be the case.
Well, that is the question, isn't it, Jeff? How much information is appropriate to be made public?
Well, of course, and that is. And just like Ron said, you do have to have some kind of investigation here. But I think that because of the kind of cloak and dagger energy that has surrounded this entire conflict from the beginning. I mean, look at the cover-up with weapons of mass destruction in the first place and whether or not they existed. I think that the larger question needs to be, in investigating issues like this, is there a system in place that operates with covering up as part of the system itself?
Mm-hmm.
So to what extent do we put things in the column, or does the military put things in the column of national security, and people like the family of the person who was killed have no way to redress or to even understand what actually happened. So I think there has to be a balance in that too.
Well, let's move on to our last topic of the day. And let me just say to all three of you, you are so articulate.
Click.
Yeah, see you, Tony.
Now, we know that compliment got Joe Biden in hot water last week, but let's talk about why. Why that's such a big deal. And all of us have heard that, I know.
Yeah.
ER, what's the big deal?
Well, the big deal is that it's not so much calling someone articulate, because on one level it is. Somehow giving praise, sometimes faint praise, but it's often used inappropriately, because where they would say that I am articulate or you are, they might not use the same word to describe a white person. So it becomes one of those phrases that has a subtext to it. They're saying, wow, black people know how to string some words together and make sense. And that's the part that's offensive.
Well, you know, Jeff Carr, I know that even in my own family, you know, my elders who are from the South, they were like, boy, you're so articulate. We're so proud of you, yada, yada, yada. And that was a sense and a source of pride. And yet when it comes from other people, you know, there are suspicions attached to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there are. And I use the term articulate a lot when I'm speaking to 3- and 4-year-olds. Who amaze me with their ability to use really large words and string them together in a sentence. So for me, I think that that's great, because I'm amazed that they're so articulate beyond their years. And when I'm sitting on a panel, and I'm from the South even, it's so interesting because I get this a lot down here. When I'm sitting on a panel with four white people or four white guys, and it's been a great panel, and literally I've seen people walk by the three white guys and say, oh, that was fabulous, I really enjoyed it, and then look at me and say, you are so articulate. And to me, when we all know what that means, it's the amazement in there, which psychologically says, I have extremely low expectations for you, so you are not the norm, you are the exception. And to me, I personally say this sometimes. I go up, and if a white guy's been really good, I say, man, you were really articulate. And they look kind of shocked.
Well, you know, to be fair, we don't have anybody who's white on the panel today, so I don't really know what's in their heart when they say this. And I would imagine that there are some white people listening to us right now who are saying, you know, you all need to get over it. If somebody says you're articulate, just be glad they gave you a compliment and move on. What about that, Ron Christie?
That's absolutely just so wrong, Tony. And I think, as the two previous panelists have said, it's almost like they're saying, you're so articulate, ... for a person of color. You know, and I got that in the White House. You know, you would go out and you would represent the administration and you would give a speech and people would say, gosh, you know, you're so articulate and you're so well-spoken. And I'd look at them and say, well, I'm a lawyer. You know, I've been to college. I mean, what do you expect? Do you expect me to come up? And I mean, what are you looking for? And so I think as all three of us have articulated, all four of us really, Senator Biden probably got himself in a little bit of hot water by saying those remarks about Senator Obama. I'm sure his intentions were pure, but we need to recognize that African Americans have done so much for this country and have contributed so much to this country that to look and refer to us as articulate or well-spoken can be an insult when put in the context of articulate as opposed to what.
You know, it's interesting that you put it that way because this is what I would call a cultural and linguistic divide. And my question is, how can we bridge this and move on? And can we do that, Jeff?
How can we do that?
Yeah.
You know, it's tough. I mean, I think it comes down to, just like when we have conversations about the whole topic of white privilege and whether it still exists, and regardless of what some foundations have declared, race is very much still a factor in America. And I think the biggest thing is being able to acknowledge that and listen to it. It's like a man with a girlfriend, and it's the traditional kind of problem. The girlfriend's talking and you don't listen. And she says, he never listens to me. He says, yes, I do. Yes, I do. And he doesn't. So I think we sometimes have people who have been, to some extent, victimized or disrespected, and we don't pay attention to them. We don't listen to their issues. So I think we're just going to have to do a lot more listening and say, if a person says across the board, this is offensive, then maybe where there's smoke, there's fire.
Maybe so. We've got to get out of here because we have run out of time. I suppose in one way you could say this is like when they used to say you're a credit to your race. But that's another conversation for another time. From our New York Bureau, E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism, Hofstra University School of Communication, Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle in Nashville, Tennessee, and at NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., Ron Christie, VP of the lobbying firm D.C. Navigators and former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Everybody, thank you again.
Thank you.
Take care, Tony.
Thank you. That I ought not to let you just walk on me. And I'm sure he meant well. Yeah, but when I talk was through, I said, brother, if you only knew, you'd wish that you were in my shoes. You just keep on using me until you use me up.